Next matter is Reinstrom Appellant, Glepco, LLC, respond.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Gary Jones. I'm here on behalf of the Reinstras. Unfortunately, I guess we have two losses in the trial court. The initial motion that was brought by the Reinstras was for dismissal of the case that Mr. Watts filed on behalf of Glepco. That dismissal motion was to be considered without regard to other evidence. Subsequently, Mr. Watts filed a summary judgment motion. For purposes of my argument this morning, I'd like to split that time between the CR 12B6 motion, do that, argue that first, and then I'll argue and rebuttal on the rest. So I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for the summary judgment motion and response to Mr. Watts. The primary contention that we have and that we think is dispositive of the case is that the pleadings filed ask the court to add Parcel B to the land that was foreclosed on. The deed of trust, the notice of trustee's sale, and the trustee's deed all specifically describe Parcel A, which is a very particular parcel of land. Effect of having court actions like the one filed by Glepco is to undermine and, in effect, destroy the predictability of a nonjudicial foreclosure process. If people that are debtors and are being foreclosed upon have to make decisions, they should make decisions based on what the deed of trust says, what the notice of trustee's sale says, and be guided by that information. If people are bidding at a sale, they must be given the opportunity to know what it is they're buying. And in this case, we have particular evidence that Pete Papadopoulos, who was a realtor, who was investigating properties for people, looked, saw that the legal description did not include the whole property, and therefore stopped researching, stopped bidding. And there are clear admissions by the Glepco principals, Hinton, that they simply didn't recognize the facts that were clearly spelled out in an asterisk at the bottom of the first page of the notice of trustee sale, to the effect that they should not rely upon a parcel number, which apparently is what they did. There was a parcel number that took them to an assessor's website, and they by their own statement, that's what they relied on rather than reading the document and rather than recognizing that they were not and should not be granted any rights after a public auction in the trustee's sale. One of the things, I think that's really the point, and I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You'll have 7 minutes. It's showing two here.
So well, you said you wanted five and five.
That's right. Interesting.
So okay. You're only 3 minutes into the five. That makes seven, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Charles Watts, Bellevue, Washington, representing the respondents who were the plaintiffs at the lower level. I sensed from the court that you didn't need a recitation about the facts. I've tried to be very complete in my submission to the court on the facts.
That's really what we're here for.
I'm sorry?
Could the court do what the court
I understand did? That. And the issue there raised by the defendants is apparently centered on RCW 61.24, the nonjudicial foreclosure statute, and I would submit that there's nothing in that statute expressly or even impliedly barring the equitable relief we seek. Counsel indicated in argument to this court that the predictability, his word, of these nonjudicial foreclosure sale would be somehow interfered with if the equity powers of the court were not restrained. I suggest that the equity powers of the court are restrained always in equity to doing right. Now, if there were an intervening bona fide purchaser for value here, if there were some other equitable justification for denying the relief we seek, then perhaps the court could have granted some kind of denied reformation, but granted some kind of restitution. As it stands right now, what the Reinstra folks want is they want their house free and clear of the debt they imposed on it. And clearly a court of equity should not countenance that. Now, we don't, we've indicated this specific issue on RCW 61.24, and the reformation remedy is perhaps one of first impression in this state, but we do have precedent in this state for reformation between non-privity parties, that is, distant parties to the transaction. So that's not a new equitable theory. That's a well-established theory. We also have the Ninth Circuit citing a 1895 decision of our Supreme Court where in a judicial foreclosure context, reformation was granted after the sale. I think I would probably be unnecessarily taking the court's time unless the court had any questions. It's my belief that RCW 61.24, in fact, contemplates in Section 050, it contemplates the legal description being amended or being deemed to include all interests of the grantor of the deed of trust in the property. Here, the interests of the grantor included a larger parcel than the legal description on the deed of trust, following a succession of deeds of trust that did include all the property. So there's just no legal basis that I can suggest exists that would deny the powers of the court of equity to reform a legal description on these facts. And as this court well knows, the exercise of equitable powers is based on peculiar facts in each situation. There may be other situations where a court would say, I should not exercise my equitable powers, but this occasion cries out for it. There just is a compelling need and justification for the exercise of equitable powers. If the court doesn't have any questions, then I will not take more time saying the same thing over and over again.
Apparently not.
Thank you.
One of the things that has been repeated in the briefing and in the argument to the trial court that we believe is wrong in this situation is that Mr. Watts claims for his clients the position of the beneficiary, GMAC, that actually did the lending and was involved in this, and fails, his briefing and his argument fails to account for the fact that his clients are bidders at a sale and that their rights are completely restricted to those rights of a bidder at a sale. The equitable relief that he talks about in Rogers and these old cases all flows from the fact that in the setting like this, the counterpart would be GMAC doesn't use the nonjudicial foreclosure. Rather, GMAC comes to court and says, we think a mistake has been made, that it's a mutual mistake, that it requires reformation. In that context, we would not be opposing the action of the court. What we're opposing is the idea that a bidder could come into a public auction where everyone else has been shown parcel A, and after they've bid on parcel A, then say, oh, by the way, we want parcel B as well. That's what's wrong with this. And the idea that somehow my clients are caught up in and all of the interest of the grantor provision in the Trust Deed Act is very wrong as well, because what is involved there is the succession of ownership. And so if there is a delay in recording or there's some other thing that might cause a defect of title out of matters of sequence or completeness of the transfer, those are to be cured in favor of the lender and to the detriment of the borrower, because those are rights that are properly conveyed, and there may be sequence problems or other things that warrant the action by the legislature to say, we want this succession interest to be recognized in the transactions for deeds of trust. That all goes to this business of making it more predictable, more efficient, more sure, and cuts completely the opposite direction of the pleadings by these plaintiffs that are trying to completely change the game on not only the debtor, but also every other member of the public who read the notice of trustee's sale and who relied upon the actions that the trustee took, those actions being supposedly for the benefit of everyone concerned, not for the benefit of the beneficiary alone, not for the benefit of the people who bid. Those people in the position of GLEPCO are to get no warranty. They are to rely completely on what they can deduce from the record. If they make a wrong deduction, it is not for the courts to come by and correct it. It is for those people who have analyzed the situation to make their bet. I mean, if you're, I guess we used to say in playing bridge, board's the play. You know, if you choose to throw down the card, that's your play, and you take what comes from that play. You can't decide later, oh, gee, I wish I'd have played the king. You know, you got to have somewhere in a nonjudicial process and a process that involves other people than just the borrower and the lender.
Well, so are you arguing that the inequity here is in the abstract other person?
Well, it's
facts as known to the trial judge precluded this exercise of equitable authority.
Well, we're saying in the summary judgment context now, you're right that it is important to take account of the Peter Papadopoulos affidavit, for example, which says, I looked at this, I saw there was a defective description, and I set this one aside. That is in the record. That's something that was argued on the summary judgment side when more evidence is being considered. And we're very convinced that the summary judgment decision was wrong.
Wouldn't you need to have, under these facts, also have him say that I would have paid $1.298 instead of 98 cents for this as a result? I mean, what he's saying is I got out of this because it was messy, but that doesn't necessarily lead you to the conclusion the trial court did was inequitable or against the public's interest.
Well, there is a Parsons appraisal, though, in the record showing a $725,000 value for this property that the people paid $283,000 for. So there is a big gap between value and what was paid. I'm not arguing to the court that there should be somehow a weighing of was this a good deal, because quite the contrary, it's our contention that in deed of trust foreclosure, the whole idea here is that there's a predictable process and you either hit the mark or you don't hit the mark as to compliance with the statute. And we believe the court's only role should be to review the procedural adequacy of the trustee's actions in foreclosing the deed of trust. That's consistent with the cases. That's what the statute says. That's what did not happen here if the court intervenes and goes around the trustee and does something other than what a trustee would do in a proper deed of trust foreclosure. And that's the vice that we believe the trial court engaged in. They didn't allow the process that should apply to everyone. Bidder, borrower, lender, everyone concerned should be subject to the same public open process in which there is a legal description, there is an identity of the property that is being bid on, and there's a final conclusion about the title of that property, that it is transferred and nothing else, nothing more or less than what was described in the documents. And that's very consistent throughout this. I mean, go back to the situation that I was facing when these people came through the door and said, what, you know, should we sign a quitclaim deed? Well, I have done trustee foreclosures. I've been involved in this process for years. It's very clear to me that if I were the trustee and I were putting down a legal description that was inconsistent with what people were thinking they were buying, that I would be deceiving someone. But that did not happen here. The trustee was very clear about saying, this is what it is. Even had an asterisk at the bottom of the first page of the notice of trustee say, don't get confused by the parcel number here. And people who were paying attention knew that and acted accordingly. And I don't think the court had any business intervening in this at the trial court level.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both of you.